I remember being at work one day, and one of the directors was speaking to me in a very stern tone of voice. But there was something about the expression on her face that told me that she might be in pain. And so I remember asking her, "Is everything okay?" And she stopped for a moment and she burst into tears and she said, "No. My mom's been ill for a very long time, and the doctors are saying that she is nearing the end of her life and that we need to start making plans for her departure." And there was so much relief that washed over her once she had been able to say that out loud. All of the sternness, all of the tension that she had been carrying seemed to dissipate. And it's not to say that she wasn't still hurting or in pain, but there was something about having to stifle that pain and keep going in order to continue to be effective that was exacerbating her experience in the moment. And so just by asking her the question, "Are you okay?" and making space for her to express what it was that she was experiencing, created space for her to process the pain that she was in such a way that she could then release it, at least in that moment, and move forward in a more constructive way, in a more generative way. I asked her if there was anything that I could do, and she delegated a few tasks to me and said that she was planning to be out for the remainder of the year. It was the holidays. And I think within the week or so, her mother did pass away. And we didn't really talk too much about it when she returned to work, but I think because I had created that space for her to share with me what she was going through, she would share certain things with me about how she was processing her grief. And she told me something that I thought was really beautiful and I think really relevant to today's episode. Her mother was a gardener, and she had passed on her gardening skills to her. And in her mother's garden was a beautiful rose bush that her mother had grown and been cultivating for many years. So when her mother died, she decided to transfer her mother's rose bush to her own garden. And this was a pretty arduous process because of the way that the rose bush had, its roots had been maybe intertwined with the roots of other bushes and flowers and everything else. So there was the process of extricating this rosebush and then transferring it and then planting this rosebush in a completely new environment. But something about being able to tend to her mother's rosebush and pour into it and cultivate it and prune it and take care of it. It was as though she was able to continue to honor the love that she had for her mother. And so while the grief was not something that went away and the pain over her mother's loss was not something that would ever go away, she found a way to integrate her mother's loss into a new reality, and part of that reality being that she could love and pour into this rose bush, which was an extension of her mother and her mother's love and her mother's talent for gardening. And I think that's a beautiful story and a great way to open up today's podcast episode about grief. It's often said that we don't fear change. We fear what we stand to lose as a result of change. And similarly, we don't fear the unknown as much as we fear that we may not have the capacity to handle the unknown. So when we're talking about change, we're really talking about loss. And when we're talking about the unknown, we're really talking about how resourceful we feel or how equipped we feel to handle the unexpected. So since we can't talk about building our capacity for change without talking about loss, conversations about change are really conversations about grief. Loss also brings up feelings of uncertainty about the future, and uncertainty makes us question our capacity to respond to the unknown. So are we resourceful? Or are we equipped to deal with what's around the corner? Maybe we're not. What if we're not? So there's a lot of fear that surrounds uncertainty, but that fear is rooted in our fear that we won't be equipped to prevent or sustain future losses. So uncertainty is also, at its heart, related to grief. So unfortunately, our society has not equipped us with a definition of grief that supports us in navigating it effectively, right? So first, we're taught that grief is linear, which many of us have come to understand is not true, right? That our experience of grief is more like a dance than walking a straight path. There's steps forward, backward, side to side. It's definitely not a straight path. But the other troubling part about this linear view of grief is that it implies that there's an end point. So we're taught there's a beginning and an end, and that acceptance is the end state. But depending on the significance or the gravity, the weight of the loss, grief can be a lifelong process. Number two, we're also taught that grief occurs in these discrete stages. So you have denial, then anger, then sadness, right? But the emotions that are associated with grief can occur and often do occur simultaneously, often as like a secondary or protective response to the primary feeling of despair that typically arises because of grief. So for example, instead of viewing denial as this discrete standalone stage, we can think of it instead as a protective response, protecting us against the despair that's sitting just underneath it, right? The despair and the denial are occurring simultaneously. And those of us with a very nuanced relationship with our own emotions and inner experiences, we know that this is often the case, that we're not either angry or sad, but oftentimes we're both. Finally, when looking at how we define grief in our society, we talk about grief like a disease, like something that needs to be treated. And this is in part because we're not taught that feelings are functional or that emotions have a purpose. So we engage with the feelings that arise from grief like they're symptoms of the underlying disease, the disease being grief. And part of this is because we pathologize everything, right? In the U.S., we've found a way to pathologize all aspects of the human experience. So in other words, we treat many natural and functional aspects of humanity, or of the human experience, I should say, like a disease. And this is rooted in consumerism, because if we can label something as a disease, we can sell you a pill. If we label something as a problem, we can sell you a solution. And a lot of us who are in entrepreneurial workshops, marketing workshops, etc., we're taught to frame your offering or your service in terms of a problem that you're here to solve. So we are taught that humans are problem oriented. But, you know, as I continue to learn more about social psychology and cross-cultural psychology, I'm not sure to what extent that belief generalizes to other cultures. I don't know that humans are innately wired to seek problems. I don't know that that's true, but I do know that culturally here in the U.S., we are trained to be problem-oriented, and to look for what's wrong. And then if you combine that with our consumerism, right, this consumerism that plagues all aspects of our lives, you get this disease pill model of humanity. And what that does is it trains us to seek singular solutions to complex or multidimensional or multifaceted problems. We want everything in pill form. So now I'm not denouncing medicine. I don't want anyone to take that and think that I'm saying medicine is not a good thing, right? But what I'm pointing to is how this mindset has encouraged us to engage with life's problems and complexities very passively. So we don't see ourselves as part of the solution to life's complexities. We don't see ourselves. We're not actively engaged in life's complexities. We're very passive, you know. And if there's no pill or solution, then we kind of talk ourselves into being okay with whatever it is we're experiencing. So we just say, well, you know, we just hope that things will go away on their own or get better someday. We say time heals all wounds, when really it's time and intention and our practices that work together, work synchronistically to heal wounds. We're taught that solutions exist outside of us and that we should rely on others who are more knowledgeable, quote unquote, to prescribe the right treatment or solution. So this is a mindset that works against us, right? And it's no wonder that many of us feel ill-equipped to face the unknown or to handle change, because we're taught to disengage with the parts of us that are designed to support us in navigating the complexities that come with being alive. And one of the things that, you know, that support us in navigating the complexities of life is our feelings, our emotions, right? So what happens when we stop seeing grief as a disease that needs to be treated or eradicated, but rather a process that supports us in integrating our losses into our new reality? Right? Well, what happens is, I think, a radical way of living and being with our emotions. You know, when it comes to loss, first I want to say that there are two aspects of loss. There's the tangible loss of a person, a job, a source of income, a career opportunity, a physical ability, a home, right? There's the tangible loss, right? But it's not just that it's not just the loss itself that hurts. It's the perceived or real permanence of the loss that incites grief, right? It's not like losing your wallet, which is distressing, extremely distressing if it's ever happened to you, right? Or losing your keys. Despite how distressful that situation might be, your keys can be replaced, your cards can be replaced. If you had a large wad of cash in there, perhaps that's not replaceable, but money can be earned again, right? But we can't bring the people we love back to life. physically, right? So when we look at the loss that is characterized by grief, it's, or the loss that incites the experience of grief, it's the permanence that really hits us. There's also the intangible aspects of loss, like the loss of one's identity, right? So when you talk about things that are meaningful to us, our relationships, our careers, you know, what we do for a living, our physical abilities, you know, those are integrated into our self-concept, right? How we see ourselves. So as a mother, right, my daughter and who she is integrated into my self-concept, my identity, right? The part of me that identifies as her mother. So this is true of everything that we engage with in the physical world. There's the intangible aspect of that relationship, our relationship to things and people and our roles that shapes our self-concept. And so losses that trigger the onset of grief are also characterized by a feeling that some aspect of ourselves is gone or altered permanently. So there's the physical loss, there's the tangible loss, but then there's the loss of your identity, or the identity that you had surrounding your relationship to that person or that thing, that role, whatever it is that you're mourning. So when we look at grief as a process that can support us in integrating those losses rather than a disease, then we can see that the emotions that arise in response to the grief process are there to guide us and serve as navigational tools, you know, in helping us decide how we move forward into this new reality. We can begin to change our relationship to grief by changing the way that we perceive and relate to our emotions. That's first and foremost. So we tend to see emotions, specifically negative emotions, as symptoms, right? Symptoms of a problem. And culturally, we engage in a lot of symptomatic problem solving. When we have a headache, we want to know what pill do we take to take the headache away. We have a back problem. Oh, my back hurts. The doctor gives you some kind of injection or a pill. The back pain goes away. But we never address what the pain was trying to tell us about the larger issue at hand, you know. But we engage with feelings in the same way, right? We think, well, sadness is a symptom that needs to be treated. Anger is a symptom that needs to be treated. And with our disease pill model of humanity, you know, we focus on treating symptoms rather than looking at what the symptom is pointing to. And then we forget that pain is functional, that feelings are functional, right? If we view them as messengers rather than symptoms, we can use them to inform our thoughts and actions rather than resisting them or allowing them to consume us, right? And this is what in dialectical behavioral therapy is referred to as our wise mind. We access our wise mind when we combine our intellectual insights with our feelings, and we combine those two, our intellect with our emotions, to create a decision, a holistic solution, rather, to a problem. So, for example, sadness is a withdrawing emotion, and it prompts a freeze survival response. It's the body's way of telling us to slow down, to withdraw, to rest. And sometimes our nervous system needs that downtime in order to process and integrate a loss. And we make this, you know, we can make this experience meaningful by honoring the sadness and giving ourselves permission to withdraw, to rest, to cry, as our body works to make sense of what we're experiencing. So by viewing sadness as functional and purposeful instead of something that's getting in the way, you know, we can more easily, the sadness can more easily serve its purpose than when we resist it. Now, some of you may be listening and thinking, well, Tamara, I literally do not have time to be sad. I still have bills to pay. I have children to feed. I have a mortgage to make. I have car payments. I have, you know, a job that I need to show up to every day. And I need to do it with a smile, you know. And that's real, right? And we may not have, some of us are not privileged in such a way that we can say, okay, I'm going to take, you know, a 3-month leave of absence so that I can mourn this loss, right? So that's not possible. Many of us are forced to continue, you know, in our roles, our various roles, with the expectation that we not sacrifice our effectiveness within those roles while also trying to integrate these losses. And it can feel unbearable. And what I will say is that, yeah, you may not have the ability to say, I'm going to take a 6-month vacation. I'm going to move to the tropics for 6 months and just sit by the beach and heal. But there are moments throughout the day, and what I invite you to do is pay attention to those moments where there are opportunities for you to sit and really be with yourself in this very intimate way. What are you choosing in those moments? A lot of us are choosing distracting behaviors. You know, we're mindlessly scrolling. We're, you know, watching endless YouTube videos. We are, you know, whatever it is that we're doing to distract, right? So a lot of us are not being intentional about our time and the moments that we do have for engaging with these very profound and sometimes painful feelings. And a lot of the reason, you know, I think the main reason we do that is because we're afraid that if we do give ourselves permission to engage with that feeling for a little while, that we'll become too consumed by the feeling. Right? And we say, well, if I give myself permission to cry, if I go outside for 10 minutes and you know, stand in the sunshine and just allow myself to feel the grief that I'm feeling, I may not be able to move, right? It may, the sadness may incapacitate me. And that's one of the reasons why we're engaging in these distracting behaviors, because we're looking for ways to do just enough to keep going. But I remember being in a personal development seminar and the lead trainer telling someone, either have your breakdown or your breakdown will have you. And it was a reminder of how these emotions, the physiology of our emotions, you know, that's real. And anything that goes unaddressed is left to manifest as physical dis-ease in the body. And a lot of us are feeling this, and there are tons of research and studies that suggest and even prove that stress, chronic stress, can impact cardiac function, digestive function, you know. This stuff really does live, our emotions really do manifest in the body if we don't address them, right? A lot of this, though, is not a personal failure, right? By not knowing how to address our feelings or feeling as if we're under-resourced or we don't have the capacity to be with our feelings, these are skills that are taught. or that need to be learned and that we're not taught in our society. We're not taught in our culture to be with our feelings. But there are tools and resources that can be utilized and leveraged to help us build our capacity for our own feelings. And this is one of the key skills involved or competencies involved in being able to increase and build our capacity for change and uncertainty. It's being with our own emotions. Anger is another emotion. It's a confronting emotion, and it prompts our fight survival response. It's our body's way of protesting a perceived injustice or violation. And sometimes a loss is preceded by something that we perceive as unjust or something that really is unjust. And if we can learn to validate our own feelings, then we can use that motivating energy of anger to do something constructive, right? We can use it constructively and intentionally. And I want to emphasize validating our own feelings because, again, in our culture, we're taught to dismiss anger, right? To dismiss and invalidate when someone feels that something is fair. And that's because we have this just world hypothesis that exists in our culture, that we feel like, well, you get what you get and life is always fair. Don't complain about it. If something sucks, do something about it. If not, be quiet. You know, it's like, and so it that's cultural. And we can at times, because that's so ingrained in our society, we can invalidate our own feelings that that our rights have been violated or our boundaries have been crossed or something's not fair. So a lot of this is really about learning to validate your own experience of anger and feelings of, you know, injustice and unfairness, inequality, whatever it is. We can think of like a divorcee, for example, who's angry about their partner's infidelity and uses that energy to get back in the gym and really start, you know, thinking, well, you know, I poured so much of myself into this marriage and got nothing in return, so let me start pouring into me, right? You have parents who are devastated, you know, from losing their child to drunk driving, coming together and starting a movement that results in the reform of policies surrounding drunk driving. So these are just examples of how anger can be used to create change, right? And how anger can be used to integrate a loss into a new reality that happens to be constructive. While that doesn't undo the pain of the loss, those constructive actions can help us integrate that loss into, or those losses into, our new concept of reality and even ourselves. So I want to end with a comment on the duration of grief. You know, there are times when we may feel that we've sufficiently integrated a loss into our lives, only to find ourselves rocked by feelings of distress or despair again. And this isn't because you failed to integrate or process the loss effectively. It's more so that a new dimension or layer of the loss has been brought to the surface that requires your attention. A lot of us who actively engage in trauma recovery understand this. You know, that there are times that you're feeling healed and happy, and then suddenly you're faced with yet another aspect of the trauma that requires your attention. And this can feel exhausting, and very disruptive, particularly if you are interpreting it as failure on your part, right? So one of the worst things that you can do is resist that, you know, resist when it comes up, when something comes up again that you thought you've worked through, and get angry with yourself, you know, beat yourself up over it. It just makes it worse. Pete Walker talks about this in his book, Complex PTSD, From Surviving to Thriving. He talks about letting go of the salvation fantasy and instead seeing healing as a lifelong process. Now, for me, I have stopped using healing, and I've been replacing healing with integration. And the reason that I say that is because healing is often viewed as, you know, a restoration process. We're looking to restore something to its original state. And when I think about grief and loss and change, the reality is that very few things are ever restored to their original state. Some things are fundamentally altered permanently. And so it's really not about restoration, but integration, integrating that loss or integrating those changes. And so we can get better at it, you know, and by better, I mean that we learn to integrate painful feelings and experiences or memories more quickly and more effectively. And this happens when we stop beating ourselves up for feeling bad. Pain points to an unmet need. And by tuning into what those needs are, what we're doing is we're actually building trust in our ability to respond to our needs. And in doing so, we build our capacity for handling life's changes and unknowns. So with that being said, thank you for listening. Feel free to reach out to me. I'm on Instagram at Dynamic Insights LLC. Would love to hear your thoughts on today's podcast. Take care.